Welcome to Discursion Podcast, the show where we discuss recently released films on DVD and Blu-ray, classic and new. My name is Stephen.
I'm Dominic.
Today we're talking about Charles Burnett's film To Sleep With Anger, which was released in 1993, I believe. 1990.
It's his third film, though. Perhaps that's what you were thinking of.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
His third feature film after what was his sort of student graduation film?
Killer of Sheep.
In stereo. Which is sort of now widely considered some kind of masterpiece. I mean, widely and quite rightly to my mind, but wasn't received particularly well at the beginning, and I think also had a long time out of circulation because of just pragmatic difficulties in getting the clearances for the music he'd used in the film. And then he made a film called My Brother's Wedding, which I confess I haven't seen. And then he made this film, which James Naremore, who's written a book all about Charles Burnett that came out a few years ago, is of the opinion that it contains Danny Glover's finest performance. I'm not sure I'm well enough versed in the work of Danny Glover to authoritatively pronounce on that, but it's certainly an extraordinary performance.
It is, yeah. A different performance to Lethal Weapon, for sure.
That's true.
But there are connections with Charles Burnett's earlier work. Danny Glover leaves an imprint, but you also have Burnett's themes of, I suppose, family melodrama, African-American culture, Los Angeles as a place.
Yep.
Class conflict.
Yeah, gender relations. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think what I really like about this film is how it's both extremely simple and extremely clear anyway, and also strangely mysterious. You know, it does something with the mood. There's a continual sense of tension, or not continual sense, but at least persistent sense of tension, which actually reminded me of something like Paul Thomas Anderson's The Master, which is in many ways an extremely different film, but sort of nothing incredibly dramatic happens in this film. There are maybe sort of two or three quite dramatic moments, but nonetheless creates all sorts of senses of menace and uncertainty,
yeah,
which are quite powerful, yeah, through quite kind of subtle means, but without being. But it also is actually quite a simple story.
Yeah, sure. The story of a an old friend who reintroduces himself to this family in LA, having travelled from the South or having drifted for some time. And he's an ambiguous character called Harry, who carries with him lots of old folk traditions and has a different idea of morality to this Christian household. Doesn't believe in sinning, he says, but believes you have to work at evil, which is, yeah, an interesting way of,
yes,
putting it. And over the course of the film, he starts to have an influence over the household. Harry has a relationship with baby brother that's particularly close and problematic, the younger brother of two.
Yes. So we should make clear that Danny Glover is Harry. Although, according to the Naremore book, apparently they initially offered him the baby brother role, because apparently he liked the thought of playing young men, even though he's clearly far too old for the character at this point. But and yes, Julius, I can't remember his last name now, but there's an actor who is in the film who was initially considered for the...
I think they chose well with Danny Glover, though, because of his...
But Julius Harris, that's, yeah, who is in Live and Let Die, I believe. I can't really... But he's the... Yeah, so he does appear in To Sleep With Anger. He's one of the kind of disreputable old men. He's the tall, bald man with a cough or with some sort of heart condition. And you can see why he in some ways he seems like perhaps a more straightforward or a more obvious choice,
yeah,
for that the character, he does have, you can easily see how he could sort of have something of the old South sort of about him, and he's more obviously an old man, at least as he performs in the film, than Harry is. But
but Danny has a physical, I know he's not as tall, but he has a girth and a physicality to him, and powerfully expressive, always grinning, and his eyes just communicate all sorts of complicated sentiments, and his voice as well, is his sort of airy voice, that kind of laugh.
It's extraordinary.
That is supposed to communicate joy, but also is very menacing.
So I mean, it's kind of a, I suppose it's the story of an element from the past kind of coming into a particular setting which thought it had gained a certain kind of stability, and he disrupts it, but also he sort of allows it to disrupt itself, right? He's a sort of disruptive force, but also he's revealing those tensions which are there anyway. So there's definitely, there's a sense that the central, I don't know, it's hard to say who the protagonists are, actually. It's worth saying it's an extremely strong ensemble cast, all based around a single family. Gideon and his wife Susie, who were in the 50s, I would guess, perhaps a bit older. Yes, and their two sons, and then the sons' wives and their children. But there's a sense that they're definitely a middle class black family in Los Angeles, but at not much removed from being a working class family. From the South. That's very much in there. Sort of biographically in the story of the film, that's in their recent past. And it's not almost nothing in the film seems to me heavy-handed. I think one of the strengths, those things that could seem heavy-handed almost come across as kind of clarity rather than obviousness to me. That was something else when I was rewatching it yesterday that struck me, that I really like, is it actually makes explicit the things that another film would, or almost explicit things that another film would sort of keep as slightly more under the hood. So this idea that Harry is perhaps in some sense a sort of devil figure, that's something there. There's a shot where he's sort of lurking at night below the stairs, and a car comes past with a red light, so he gets shot in a red light. But then, which might seem a little bit heavy-handed, say the least, but then one of the characters more or less sort of says that he's the devil, so that's something which is, or she says that he's a force of evil. So it's not a subtext, it's part of what the film is about, but it's also part of what the film is questioning, because just at the point when the film finally makes it explicit that this is what's going on, it then undercuts it, and you actually perhaps are given chances to feel some sympathy for Harry just at the point when your sympathy might have evaporated. It keeps doing these really quite complex things, while, as I say, being never... never fussy or muddled.
Yes, absolutely. There's a sequence where Patty, who is an old acquaintance of Harry's, she used to live in the South and now she lives in LA, and she says she's...
I think she might be called Hattie.
Hattie, not Patty. Now she says she's been saved because she's a Christian. And she's one of the few characters that... is quite clear that she doesn't like Harry and thinks he's a dangerous man, and says things like, like the moon, he only shows his good side, but on the, behind it's all black, it's darkness, And then you later on cut to a shot of dark storm clouds passing the moon. But it's the film I think weaves these images together in quite a subtle way that it doesn't rely on symbolism, but it uses symbolism to communicate these themes, exactly. Which I think is the important distinction.
Yes, but I think, as I sort of touched on earlier, I think, again, it's made so effective, and this is by no means unique to this film, and it does it really well, by the fact that those things are symbols, are symbolic for the characters within the film. So it's not sort of imposed as a authorial way of organising things. It's also reflecting what the characters are experiencing, which I think is, that's often quite a good way of. I feel that maybe that's something that films do quite a lot and is perhaps slightly under-recognised. But I think it's often a good, an effective way, I think, of integrating symbolism and sort of avoiding those. The sense of it feeling. The things that someone like a V.F. Perkins would object to, or would have objected to, that this was the author sort of stamping on the film and sort of telling the audience what to think.
Charles Burnett has a nice phrase. He says that he uses music to suggest another world, and I think you could say the same is true of his visual symbols as well. He suggests, he doesn't impose, and the world always comes from the character's past or present feelings, usually towards Harry because he's such a dominant force, but also this family has existing problems that Harry is sort of making clearer and problematizing. But there's a wonderful moment between Susie, the matriarch, and Harry. He's just entered the household, and they're talking about how in the South you have to have a very clear understanding of social hierarchy and respect for one another that seems to be lacking in the youth today. Mm. That's really in reference to baby brother, who's a rebellious, sort of cast as a lazy but also a complicated figure. Just as they're talking about that, the lovely Southern soundtrack comes in, and Susie turns slowly to Harry and says something along the lines of, you had to know your manners. And they have that lovely harmonica coming in, and the sun is setting, and you get that magic hour kind of light. And it does suggest another world in a very subtle way that's evocative of how those characters are interacting in that moment.
Yes. But it's also, so crucial. This is also a part of the African-American kind of culture that the film is both representing and kind of drawing on, is how important storytelling is to the entire sort of culture. So it's not just that, it's not that Harry comes in as a sort of a kind of fraudulent sort of trickster sort of telling stories. He comes in and tells a certain kind of stories among people who already do. I mean, there's a very good... what I thought was a very good joke earlier on that Gideon tells about a group of preachers confessing. Which activates all the same themes about sin, but also a kind of sense of humour about
this. This is the story about the sinners having to confess, and they all confess to various things, various vices like alcoholism and being addicted to corn liquor and so on. And then the last sinner confesses to being a gossip.
Yes, which he says is the worst sin, but
Wait to tell everyone all of these confessions.
But it's also, Gideon's telling this to his grandson, who doesn't really appear to understand the joke. So there's something again there about history and sort of transmission and family and folklore and... but again, that's all done with a light touch. It's not. And then that's a moment right then when a broom falls and smashes a teapot, sort of seemingly for no reason. So there are all these sort of hints or things, sort of magical things do seem to happen. Yeah. But it's very deliberately kind of balanced that all of them are also potentially explainable just as coincidence.
Harry's entering a household and entering an area of LA where a lot of characters think that they've settled, and he, through his force of personality, actually says, no, you're still in transition, and that becomes quite clear in the generational divisions between the characters. failures of communication and misunderstanding.
It's also, I was just thinking that, you know, I think, isn't this right? Isn't the actual, I mean, we often talking about films about certain characters or events or things as catalysts, but I think if I think back to my GCSE chemistry, I have a vague memory that a catalyst changes or speeds up a reaction, but isn't it actually affected itself? I think that's a
it's not the stimulant. But you know, everything.
It's not sort of consumed. It just it makes these things happen, but the actual catalyst isn't altered. And so there's a sense in which maybe Harry is a catalyst in a slightly more literal sense, because he. One reading, at least, of the film, is it sort of revealed by the end that he's pretty consistent throughout. You know, it's all the change is just sort of provoked by his presence. So there are all sorts of moments where something bad will happen, and there'll be a sort of again this sense of menace I was talking about earlier. You know, the impression will be given that Harry is somehow involved just by the way he's filmed or something, or is about to do something. Particularly malevolent, but then when you think back, actually nothing happened, and all that happened was a shot of Harry with a particular sort of expression. So the film sort of asks you to read more sort of malevolent action into him than, which is not to say that he doesn't do a bunch of things which problematic. You know, he does want to take baby brother away from his family and, you know, back to the South. But yeah, it also sort of asks us to read him the way that the people around him are reading him. But then also, I mean, I think it's particularly clear on a subsequent viewing. I think it's how much the film sort of also opens him up to projection. And in fact, on one level, he's an old man who just wants a nice time, you know.
Yeah.
You know, he has. He's, you know, he likes his liquor and he's lazy and he's, you know, misogynistic. But he's not. But all those things could seem more kind of venal than actually really awful. Or it is possible to see him as somehow some sort of force of evil. But those two things seem to coexist.
Yeah. Yes, I agree. You could read it in both ways. You could read him as evil incarnate, or you could read him as a person who's just being who he is. A lot of the, as we've said, if he's a catalyst, a lot of the consequences come not really from direct actions on Harry's part. He just seems to exacerbate things that were already there under the surface. So, for example, when he's taking a walk with there's a key moment when he's taking a walk with Gideon along the railroad, and he says, "This reminds me of when, you know, of laying tracks," and the harmonica comes in again, and Gideon looks over and he has a vision of the past, and sees these labourers, black labourers, slaving away on the railroad, and then suffers a stroke, and so this is nothing that Harry has really done to hurt Gideon. It's just that he's sort of been present, and his presence has brought up, you know, old memories. And it's not quite clear if there's a causality between those memories and the stroke. It's just the timing of this.
Exactly, it's all about mystical. Timing. Yes, absolutely. and then later when Harry dies. At that point in Gideon recovers, you know. So you could say, well, this is precisely how sort of superstition or magic works. Mm-hmm. You know, it works on it's how astrology works, and, you know, it works on assuming that some sort of synchronicity is actually you know, causative.
They continue to normal responses you can always read as more mystical than they actually are, or more superstitious than they actually are. So when Harry's dies and falls on the floor in the kitchen, and his corpse remains there, the characters trying desperately to get an undertaker to remove the body, and they just can't do it, and it's a weight on the household.
Yeah.
And you feel the weight isn't just because there is a corpse in the kitchen on a sort of mundane practical level. It's also that there's an evil presence in the kitchen, perhaps. There's an ambiguous
presence.
But
it also slips into a sort of social black comedy at that point is also. And as has been pointed out, like, one could definitely, like, a title for the film that would work would be The Trouble with Harry.
I was about to yeah. Although Charles Burnett has not mention that in the interviews I've seen. I don't know if it's a source.
No.
But the idea of a troublesome corpse called Harry has certainly been used before.
No, I wouldn't say the film is terribly Hitchcockian, you know, but it... I can't believe that someone as educated in a film as Charles Burnett was... It may not have been, you know, the seed from which the film grew, but I can't believe he was entirely unaware of it, so...
Mm.
I mean, perhaps he was. It seems unlikely. It seems that there's at least
There's a bit of iconography there with the shoes sticking out.
Yeah,
that reminds me of Hitchcock. But
yeah, why is the film? This is an interesting thing. Why is it not the things that we've been saying about how, you know, it's interpretable as magic, but also those things could all be explained away as a response to coincidence or just simply coincidences and things. I remember Kim Newman on some sort of DVD extra, I think potentially accompanying Jacques Tourneur's Night of the Demon or something else, talking about his dislike for a certain kind of ghost story, which, you know, or sort of horror film, which attempts to get a more cultural respectability by precisely using this kind of ambiguity, right? So it's just, you know, as if to say, well, those films that actually have ghosts and monsters and zombies are all for lower class, you know, they're unsophisticated there. But now we can make terribly. Oh yes, you know, it's like Henry James, you know, and so sort of appealing for a certain kind of cultural sort of cachet somehow through saying, oh well, we don't really take ghosts entirely seriously. We're investigating what it means to respond to these things, and yeah, and his sort of dislike of this, you know, is just kind of an excuse or a way of having your cake and eating it. Now, why does this film not seem to me to inspire that response? You know, to have that kind of response to this film would seem to me to be unfair. But I can see exactly what Kim Newman is saying about other things. Because there are, again, the evil, other sort of horror film connections, or again, things that the film sort of makes almost explicit. We mentioned Harry, these old, sort of elderly African-American men who he seems to somehow, who sort of appear when he appears. And there's references to him, a character refers to him having conjured them up. And Junior, the older son's wife, talks about them as resurrected
friends.
Yeah, so this idea that there's a ghost story, that they're there, like, that's again something which the film sort of folds into the way the characters are thinking about what's happening, but of course it isn't a ghost story in any literal sense. But yeah, I'm not sure I have an obvious answer to that question.
I think it's important that it's, although there are supernatural aspects, it's socially embedded, and you see how the characters respond to this, and they use those ritual behaviours and beliefs as a kind of lifeline, as a kind of security. But those beliefs are always competing with other values. So whether that's Christianity, or whether that's the idea of a sort of aspiration to middle class, more sanitized, sort of environment, where these darker connotations don't have so much authority. This is what Baby Brother's wife represents, the idea you have some kind of control over your own destiny, which is more determined by your professional status.
Yes. There's a quite funny moment when Gideon has had his stroke and is in bed, and the local pastor and his group of singing women all...
May we pray over Gideon?
Yes, to which, you know, no is clearly not an acceptable answer. And they come and then are... The pastor is particularly disapproving to find that Susie has employed a number of kind of folk, you know, remedies as well, has been quite happy to have them, or I think fairly happy to have them pray over him. Nobody says anything apart from the pastor, but there's a lot of kind of sanctimonious looks of sort of self-satisfied looks of disapproval, which are quite funny, which I think there it's fairly clear where the film stands. I don't mean that the film stands against the Christianity, but it certainly seems to me to stand for the compatibility of these different... Yeah, I mean, I have no idea what, you know, Charles Monnet's actual beliefs are, but it seems that the film seems to be saying that something distinctive and rich about this particular, about the African American culture that the film shows, is precisely the interaction of these.
I think he's
different traditions.
He's just very good at directing groups so that you pick up on this conflict even when it's not verbalized. Mm. That staging of, so you're seeing the choir from Gideon's perspective. So you're lying in bed and you're looking to the foot of your bed and you see your wife and the pastor and the choir surrounding you in the purple gowns, which is replicating the same staging that's used earlier in the church, which is quite a low angle shot of the choir singing and the pastor sort of doing his thing, and it's an awkward comedic.
Or it's quite oppressive, but also Gideon is unconscious. And in fact later that's replicated. There are shots from Harry's point of view when he's dead.
I hadn't thought of that, but yes. I'm not quite sure what to do with it, but he's clearly thinking in schematic terms at times about how these groups work together, and the party sequence is a great example of that as well, where they have this gathering. It's both Gideon's family and Harry's resurrected friends, and you see there each character or each couple is introduced serially as they come through the door, and you get the reaction from Harry and Susie as they're welcoming them in, and later on the characters sort of interweave and segregate. So Gideon will go outside and have an angry debate with his son about childcare, and meanwhile Harry's in the kitchen drinking corn liquor with his old friends
and then having a very threatening conversation with one of his old, well, not one of the oldest, not one of the particular group of old men, but with a character called Marsh, who I'm not quite... I think he might be Hattie's brother. I'm not quite clear, anyway. But he wants... Yeah, there's things about who killed who in the... And it's a quite tense conversation where Marsh is trying to get information out of Harry. But it's both tense but playful on both sides. Yeah. There's quite a lot of danger, but it's also a game that they're playing.
It's quite Chaucerian, that idea of beds, being in the wrong bed in the dark. That's the story, isn't it? That Harry and a woman and a man have found themselves in the dark in a room, and there's a competition between the two men.
He tells that story earlier. He tells to baby brother and his wife, but then it seems there's clearly a connection to the same incident or related incidents, but there's also something in the conversation with Marsh about... as I understood it, there's a conversation about somebody who is taken to have been lynched, but it's obviously a black man, but that this has been faked because who would lynch someone in a cinnamon tree or something? So the implication being that Harry's murdered somebody, and then...
What difference does it make if it's an oak tree or a cinnamon tree? This film could have been called Rumours of Harry as well.
Yeah, right.
Because although that... A lot of the characters are interested in, telling each other stories about the Bible or jokes about sitting. There are a lot of stories about Harry too, which Harry neither confirms nor denies, yes. And often just mystifies.
Absolutely. Well, he even says, like, when he's telling the story earlier to baby brother, he sort of says that he doesn't know whether he's mixed up his memories with something that somebody else did, you know, which is potentially a very complicated, you know, to try and work out the truth content of that is, yeah, I think quite complicated. You know the least about the youngest people in the film, but they're sort of important, kind of marginal, and you often see, you at least see them observing. Mm. It doesn't sort of kind of directly give you access to their consciousness, I think, but they are, yeah, there is at least some sense of them experiencing this world that they only partly understand. But then there's, yeah, a lovely sort of moment at the end when the trumpet playing boy who really can't play the trumpet sort of magically becomes able to play the trumpet as the final music is playing, which I think was actually very effectively done.
Hmm.
Be really pedantic and ask about the diegetic and non-diegetic status of the sound, it's really quite complicated because the supporting music comes in under the boy's incompetent trumpet playing, and that lasts for quite a while, but then it doesn't just sort of go, it then cuts to and this is happening while the family are leaving the house, so you can't see him, but then it cuts to you being able to see him, and the trumpet playing instantly but quite subtly turns into really accomplished trumpet playing while you're still seeing the boy. So there's, yeah, you can't sort of pin down in any straightforward sense what the character's really hearing and what is...
The film has these thresholds. So at the beginning you mentioned the director's credit overlapping with a child, and the opening sequence is itself fairly magical.
It's
actually a dream sequence. Mm. And the end has this transition as well, which feels fairly magical. And so although the film has a specific time and space, it also has this otherworldly quality, which Charles Burnett has mentioned in interviews, this idea of suggesting another world. I like this story, and I wonder if we could apply it more broadly to Charles Burnett's filmmaking, the story that Harry tells about the child. Oh, it's more of a statement. He says that he's asked directly by Susie, who needs to know if there's an evil man in her house. He's asked, are you a friend? And Harry says, I'm like the child next door, essentially. If he was a friend, he'd stop playing the trumpet and stop irritating people. However, if we stopped doing that, he wouldn't be perfect at what he does one day. And I wonder if we can imagine Charles Burnett as a kind of agitator, because he said in his own group of filmmakers in the 70s and 80s who were trying to work out what a kind of African-American cinema would look like, discussions would end in conflict and would end in people being irritated mm. because they felt so strongly about their craft and they couldn't decide on what ideal. Mm. And so it's not a sort of collegiate image of music making, filmmaking. It's
right.
one of it's more there's friction and there's difficulty. And as we know, tragically, Burnett's career is marked by this difficulty of trying to get funds together to make a film. And and so, yes, I think there are definitely ways in which Burnett's own experience as a creator finds itself into the film.
Yeah, you could to mistake it for it being ultimately a little tame, you know, and sort of not really going through on the consequences of the violence. But I think actually it's just doing something more. It's playing with your expectations in a quite subtle way, you know.
Yeah.
He's also able to do quite interesting thing, Burnett is, with because there's lots of really good dialogue and really well delivered, well written dialogue. I don't think it's a very improvisational film. I mean, it was shot in just a month, I think, so I think it was really quite tightly controlled. But also is able to do things. So when able to do things without dialogue or with sort of with unclear dialogue. So there's a sequence when baby brother's wife is having to serve Harry and all his friends, and is sort of increasingly being ignored and getting increasingly upset. But it would have been easy to kind of have written a lot of dialogue which underlined this all the more clearly, or had them being explicitly misogynistic. But you can't really make out what people are saying. It's too confused. You can hear bits of stories. And similarly, when the two brothers have their reconciliation in the hospital, because they share a joke, because the a woman on the reception explains that the reason it's so busy is because it's a Friday and it's a full moon, so they make some. But again, I think a more obvious filmmaker would have written them some lines which would have made this terribly clear. But you know what they're talking about, but you can't actually really hear what they're saying. But it's somehow that's used very effectively. But I think it's quite brave to have these important moments and have people speaking, but not to sort of do what the film's doing, kind of through the dialogue.
Yeah, it's, you get it from Susie's perspective, and it's enough for her.
Yeah.
To see her son smiling and joking in the distance, so she doesn't need to know the details. The effect is obvious enough.
Yeah. Good.
Thanks for listening to Discursion, episode 8. We've enjoyed talking to you about this Criterion edition of To Sleep With Anger, directed by Charles Burnett, released 1990. We'll be back soon with another film. Please do follow us on Twitter. We're also on Podbean and Spotify and iTunes. My name's Stephen.
I'm Dominic.
And we'll see you next time.
Thank you.